If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
To understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. This is the final stream tonight, and it wasn't scheduled, but it was put together hastily. Now, Aidan has been on Millennial before, but it was a long time ago. It was 2017. I think she'll be known to most of you. She is a YouTuber. That was how I first knew her. Now she's also on Twitter, of course. I think all of that will be linked. If it isn't, it will be linked from the website, millennial.com. Aidan, welcome back to the show. Since it has been so long, 8 years, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Aidan Paladin. I am a social scientist by trade originally. However, I became quite disgusted personally and professionally with academia a long time ago and decided that my skills there, I guess, would probably actually be put to better use by talking about things I was interested in on the internet to people who would be interested in them, rather than trying to talk to undergraduates in an extremely hostile environment within academia.
Yeah. What exactly happened? Did you choose to leave, or were you cancelled, as people say? Well, how did that play out?
No, I was a doctoral school student, and a lot of it was I was overworked, and I was taking a sabbatical, and I was talking to my dad every day. It was the Trump 2016 election was wrapping up. I started my channel on the day of Trump's inauguration, and in that period, the previous semester when I was taking my first sabbatical, I just wanted to talk about politics, and I was talking to my dad about it every day, and he said you should go scream into the void about it instead. So that's what I've been doing.
All right. And I seem to remember that the last time you were on, we ended up with you answering. Of course, we were on YouTube then. I was on YouTube, and there were a lot of super chats. It was a much more free-flowing thing back then. And I remember that you ended up answering lots of questions about genetics and population, that immigration, that kind of thing, because that was the kind of thing that, it's still the kind of thing that my audience is interested in. I think at that time you were more of a centrist, sort of skeptic.
Libertarian.
Libertarian. Yeah. And would you say that that's still true?
I'm not a libertarian because libertarianism is not a functional system under the current gestalt. I'm a monarchist, however. That is the big change that happened there. Read Eric von Kuhnau Leiden, read more Hoppe than I had read at the time, and came to the conclusion that a democracy is a completely failed system of government, and that monarchy is a preferable system. So
let's go into that. That's an interesting entree there, because, and I agree with you, democracy just, it doesn't work. It definitely doesn't work in our age, but I think even in the best of times, certainly mass democracy, the universal franchise, I think it's just a farce. But why don't you go into, I don't want to put words into your mouth, why don't you say, you say that democracy is a failed system. Would you say that it is inherently ridiculous, or just that it's failed in our time?
I think it can't succeed. Ultimately, the bend of time will always curve in the same direction, which is this is what we're experiencing now is what all democracies will experience, because ultimately people are fickle and people are going to vote based on whatever they think is in their best interest or whatever is most popular in the current time. These are the common critiques of democracy. But why monarchy, I think, is a preferable system is because you do have a longitudinal, stable figure who is tied to the land. People, and particularly politicians who are selected amongst them, have no tie necessarily to the land or its people, as they will obviously be replaced. And so it's in their best interest to get in and get while the going's good and get out. That's not really an option for a monarch, nor is it for the people who have to live in that country. But it is, to a certain degree, for elected politicians.
That's a very concise way of putting the problem. I think there are multiple problems of democracy, but that's a good one. That's a really interesting one, where the politician is not, I mean, he might be tied to the land, he might be very fond of it, or he might not be. And the interest, especially in a sort of corporate capitalist society such as ours, the interest will naturally tear the politician away from his land and people, even if he does start out with attachment to those things. They will offer him trinkets and you know, whatever, bribes, blackmail, so as to detach him. And then, of course, he's got a sinecure afterwards in some corporate board or charity or whatever. So all sorts of reasons to betray his people. And I guess those don't apply really with a monarch, because he's always going to be, he by definition, he's tied to his people.
His progeny is as well. Genetically, evolutionarily, we of course want to take care of our children. And so if a monarch destroys the country for temporary gain, he's destroying it ultimately for his children, and therefore destroying his own ability to propagate his genes in perpetuity.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Are there other problems with democracy as you see it?
Numerous and multifold. But one of the things that I think democracy does also is that it instills in people a truly insidious belief that they are responsible for what happens within government, and that they can vote their way out of it when they really don't have any of this power whatsoever. And it gives people a great deal of anxiety. I've looked at this over the last couple of years in some of the psychological research and found that, for example, the very act of voting instills anxiety in people. It causes them psychological distress. And also when then their elected leader does something they don't approve of, as Trump is certainly demonstrating currently, it causes them cognitive dissonance, psychological pain, because from their perspective, they have invested their time, energy, their actions, most importantly, the behavior. They've invested a behavior in supporting this person. And therefore, via the way that people understand democracy, it means I am responsible. I who have made the choice to vote or support this person, somehow now I am responsible for it. And so it becomes an extension of the self. When your guy doesn't live up to expectations, yeah, it hurts. It hurts people quite a lot. And it's very difficult sometimes to let go of that, for in the case of Trump again. Once you've invested by voting, then it becomes very difficult to divest.
And I think this also gets to a matter of hierarchy and natural hierarchy, which again is something that I don't really think is taken seriously by libertarianism. If it is, then I've missed it. Most people shouldn't have political power because they're not fitted for it. And as you say, it damages them, it harms them. They become obsessed with it, but they're actually powerless to do anything about it. But there's this illusion that they do have power. But even if they did have power, they couldn't handle the complexity of the issues or make the tough decisions, have the fortitude to do that. So I think for all sorts of reasons, most people just shouldn't be voting, and they shouldn't really be in. I mean, I think there should be some way for them to register their desires and their grievances, of course. But there always was.
Yeah.
So... I agree with you. I think this is just one more reason why it's a farce. And then you could talk about the media, how basically most of the time, with the exception of Trump 2016 and 2024, maybe, and Brexit, the referendum, every other election, it seems to be that basically the media decide how it is going to go, who's going to win, and then they astroturf that candidate and they get the result they want. It seems to happen again and again. So it's just absurd.
Yeah. And media psychology was my initial focus when I was in academia. And the reality is that the media has very little ability to tell people what to think in terms of their opinions, but it has an incredible capacity to tell people what to think about, what issues are most important and what issues are not important. That's agenda setting theory. It's McCombs and Shaw. It's the strongest correlation I've ever seen in the social sciences. It's a correlation of 0.98 between what the media reports on and what topics people think are most important.
That's amazing. 0.98. Yeah. That's incredible. So they set the agenda. They decide which issues are going to be considered important and for the election to hinge on. Amazing. And I mean, not surprising, but I'm amazed at that sheer intensity of correlation.
It's an old study, but there have been replications of it over the years, and it's largely found to be consistent, because people always ask, well, that was with, you know, newspapers and radio, what does the internet do? And it seems to be consistent. Mass media still sets the agenda.
Well, yeah, and why else would you want to run the mass media if not to set the agenda?
Yeah.
I guess to make loads of money, sure, but also
bonus.
Power.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is something, but it's kind of funny talking about this in the age of Trump, because that seems to be a break from that kind of thing. It seems, as I said before, it seems that the electorate certainly in 2016, the American electorate defied the media, the mass media. That was a whole thing. I don't know if we talked about this in 2017. We probably should have, but maybe we did. I don't know. That was this moment where the mainstream media had a sort of nervous breakdown that the public hadn't done what they told them to do. And so they came up with this concept of fake news. People might not remember this, but that literally emerged. I mean, maybe it existed before then, but it emerged massively in the month or 2 months after that election. So in late November, December 2016, suddenly this concept was everywhere. And I think that they had invented this or seized upon it as the explanation for why the electorate had done this. It was fake news. It was rivals to them who were lying. They were telling the truth. These fraudsters were lying and had hoodwinked the electorate and fooled them into voting for this imbecile. And it's amazing that was them hoodwinking themselves. That was them preserving their worldview. But anyway, I'm talking too much. So what do you think about this? If you can remember back how many years? 9 years.
I think that it did take them by surprise. They were more well prepared, obviously, Trump's second time around, or third time around, you know, however you choose to interpret that. But I think in 2016, it was kind of the right period of time for there to be a possibility for free information access that was not completely controlled by outside forces or overarching forces. Because that was, I mean, Trump in 2016, in many ways you could argue, was elected by 4chan or another, like, you know, very niche corners of the internet, not directly in terms of votes, but indirectly in terms of the incredible media campaign and popularity that and almost deification that surrounded definitely deification that surrounded him, certainly monarchistic sort of imagery that surrounded Trump was very common in 2016 and the first term in general. That kind of stuff all just popped up from people in these little different corners of the internet who were able to post kind of whatever they wanted without as much overreach as followed it. And the overreach that followed it followed for a reason. Or so I would expect.
Yeah. I was looking for an amusing meme of Trump to illustrate what you were saying there, but I think everyone gets the idea. Yeah, it did seem like something different. It seemed like America hadn't, I don't actually know if America has ever, maybe before our time, before our era, there was a similar phenomenon as Trump. But if so, I haven't heard about it. It seemed Yeah, I mean, there was a reason people were saying the God Emperor. Obviously, it was tongue in cheek, but there was also something true about, like something accurate about it, that this is how we feel about him.
I think there still is. And that's another reason, you know, why I've come to understand monarchy better as a natural system, a natural hierarchy of government. People want Trump or wanted Trump to be king. They wanted a strong authority figure to make decisions for them, to take care of them. Everyone sort of does to a certain extent. It's much easier to divest yourself again of responsibility and let a father figure, whether it be father of the nation, father God, to kind of take control of the wheel. That reduces people's psychological anxiety.
And you see, it's interesting to hear you say it that way, because I can imagine a leftist in the 90s saying right wingers just want to be looked after. They just want someone else to take charge so that they don't have to think about the complex issues. And it's a sort of self-infantilizing thing. But I think it's, I don't think it's specific to the right. I think it's
No.
in general. And you do get high IQ, or well, certainly midwit level leftists who are intellectually inquisitive, but even they ultimately are looking for someone else to tell them what to think
Yes.
demonstrably, because it happens time and time again. Hence the midwit meme. So I think this is true. This is just something in human nature. With Trump, yeah, I can easily imagine that. Of course, people want things to just be taken care of. Of course, they do. I think it's quite natural. I don't think it's something that people should be embarrassed about. And I think this is a
No.
good example of the media and leftists telling people you should feel guilty about this thing that is natural and right and healthy.
Yeah, it's natural order. I mean, why should the average person who goes and works a 9-to-5 job or whatever it is have to worry about geopolitics? First of all, he doesn't know anything about it. He's going to have to invest a huge amount of time to know anything about it. And that just has no bearing in his day-to-day life. So, of course, we'll let someone else take care of that, someone who's qualified. And the sort of lie of democracy is that we collectively can choose the best person for the job when that's not necessarily the case, either because those people are also not trained because they don't have a connection to the land, whatever it is. A monarch would be trained from birth and learn from birth about matters of foreign and domestic policy. Whereas, very often, as is the case in democracy, just the most charismatic person wins, almost never the most intelligent one, or at least not the most intelligent alone. They have to have the charisma with it, but that's
Yeah, of
rare.
course. Of course. Yeah, I mean, I think it's we're in agreement that we're both monarchists, so we both like this idea that of someone who is tied to the land and tied to the people and has their best interests at heart, but if only because he doesn't want to get beheaded.
Yeah,
He
sure.
doesn't want them storming the castle.
Or his sons to be
And
beheaded. So it makes sense to also raise your
indeed.
children in a way that they don't get beheaded. So from a long-term like life history strategy for of evolution, it makes sense for a monarch, someone who is in charge of a country, to not just be a good king, but to make good kings.
Yeah, exactly. And again, with democracy, that impetus just isn't there. It's one of those things where you think, we already had this worked out. How did we get so misled? I don't just mean recent times. I mean just the last 200 years. And I obviously that's a huge scope. I'm not asking you to answer that question, but it feels like another way in which we need to return to the past. We need to restore something that existed before, and which our ancestors foolishly, misguidedly, got rid of or supplanted. Do you think that's realistic in the American context? I don't, I mean, it might happen in Europe. It might happen, like European families, royal families being restored and reinstated with their power. But in the American context, there's no history of that.
Yeah, that's something that on my podcast, Broken Crown, which I host with my co-host Spoon, who's also a monarchist, we've talked about this question a lot. I'm not sure if there was anyone was going to become American monarch, at least that I could fathom. Now, of course, there was a possibility of George Washington becoming one, but that didn't occur. So I thought maybe in 2016 in particular, 2017 even, 2018, and also maybe around 2024 again, when Trump's return, I thought, well, it seems people want to make him and his entire family into the monarchs of America. And I don't think that's happening now, but if you had asked me a year and a half ago, I might have said it seems that people, and just from, you know, seeing what people were talking about on the internet and seeing about what people were talking about on the news, et cetera, there was that great desire of someone please save us. We're struggling under this dementia-riddled old coot, and we want someone to save us and take control and take aggressive charge to be somewhat authoritarian. And the thing about the left-right divide there, as you mentioned earlier, for years and years, all of the social science denied that there was such a thing as left-wing authoritarianism. That's, of course, obviously nonsense prima facie. But now they have developed an instrument for left-wing authoritarianism. And what we find with people who are high in left-wing authoritarianism is that, yes, the desire for a strong authority figure is present in those people as well as it is in people with quote-unquote right-wing authoritarianism. That instrument, I don't necessarily agree with the titling of it as authoritarianism. It just means essentially desire for, again, and this is in terms of why what people prefer democracy or why they like democracy. It's that idea of kind of being able to acquiesce control and preference for that, or people who are very, very individualistic, and they at least think they want personal choice. And these tend to be different personality traits. So different people will lean different ways, and they can lean different ways at different points in their life.
Yeah, indeed. That thing about personal choice is important because, as you say, it's like, I think people want to feel like they're making mm-hmm. choices, but not actually to make choice. They want someone right. else to have the responsibility.
Yes. Yes, that's the biggest part of it. People love to have choices, but they don't want to be responsible for their choices. And that's fine. I it's not meant to be demeaning. Just we don't, you know, if you make the wrong choice, well, you don't want to be responsible for it. If you could pass the buck, you would. Or most people would, I think.
Yeah. So how much do you want to talk about the second Trump presidency, this now, this 2025? Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about the farce of Biden? Because a lot's happened since you were last on Millennial.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we could talk about all of this, but I am interested in your perceptions of the Biden presidency. And I will put up one photo from that that I always think is just so amazing. Let me see if I can find it. It will either be under Biden or COVID. So it might take me a minute to find this. But there were numerous moments during his presidency and before when he was campaigning when it seemed surreal.
Oh,
that
yeah.
America was under this. This is the most, supposedly, the most powerful man in the world. And he's, commander-in-chief and all that. Okay, I can't find it under Biden. That's going to be annoying because the COVID section is voluminous. Mm. I'm going to have to just find it myself. But it was that image of them all. He's wearing the mask and he's heading into an auditorium that was apparently empty or near empty. But it was all stage managed so that it looked like he was heading in to give this rousing speech to a crowd.
Yeah.
There were numerous things like that. And then another one was where he was supposedly in the White House, but it looked like it had been green screened. There were several,
right.
yeah. several things like that.
They had a different set for some of his speeches that was not the normal place that the speeches were given. It was somewhere inside the building, so he could give it from the privacy of the White House, or a certain part of it that was away from the rest of the reporters. At least I heard that, and I remember seeing evidence of it as well. But it was all very strange. And in fact, what it was hyper-reality. The entire Biden presidency was hyper-reality. And seeing, I think, how far you could push hyper-reality and people still go along with it. And COVID, as part of that, was probably the most predominant example. How far can you get people to believe in something that is so absurd on its face that you can wear a little cloth face mask and this disease that is so deadly, it will kill you at any second, will not affect you. Well, you can, take a puff of your vape and blow smoke through it. Make that one make sense. It doesn't. but it was all the narrative that was spun around it. It wasn't even, it was not just real. It was hyper real. It was beyond real. And that's, I think, yeah, what gives it a, that whole era, a strange dreamlike quality to it when I remember it.
Yes. I found one picture, but unfortunately it's not showing in StreamYard. But it was that, here we go. This one will work. And yeah, this kind of thing was surreal. Hold on a minute. This.
Yes. Yeah.
So it, I don't even know what's going on exactly. It's some sort of new, red Indian.
I guess somebody for Africa. It's some African native thing. Yeah.
African. Yeah. African. And like maybe Kwanzaa. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's Chuck Schumer. And yeah. I can't remember her name. Is it Nancy Pelosi? Pelosi? Yeah. And they're wearing the masks.
Mm-hmm.
And except for Chuck, who I think is skipping at that time. And, you know, this sort of thing was absolutely bizarre.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are many other such images that I could present, but I think people can remember it, this era. So, yeah, please keep talking about you forget. You know, it's 5 years ago.
Not just that. There's been some speculative research done on this, specifically regarding COVID. And by that, I mean, it's been speculated about in academic publications. But there is plenty of research that's been done on other sort of events. When events are incredibly tragic and devastating, as COVID was in many ways to people, because a lot of people took that very seriously. And they really believed all of it. They believed that their lives were in danger. That evokes mortality salience, thinking about death. When people are thinking about death, there's pretty much nothing they want to do other than not think about death. So in research on mortality salience, what we find is that people will forget whatever experience they were going through that caused them to think about death or dying. They will actively forget about. There was a study, I think it was, or not a study, an article. It was either published in the Atlantic or in the New York Times or something, and it was titled, "We Will Forget Much of the Pandemic, and That's a Good Thing." And they were right, and that's because people build these psychological barriers in their brain around traumatic events. It's the same way that sort of that PTSD functions in terms of neuropsychology. If you ask people questions about COVID, they are incredibly warped. The memories are distorted. People also do not want to think about that time period whatsoever. There has been some research on that. They just don't want to think about it. It causes them psychological distress. And so in an incredibly malicious and sickening way, all of the lies that were told about COVID, in many ways, they did get away with and will always get away with, because people just do not want to revisit those memories. Whatever side they were on, it was such a weird time that people just don't want to think about it, so they don't. And then that means, I think, also a big part of the Biden presidency, because it was tied up with COVID, is also very dreamlike, because everything about COVID was so hyper real. Again, like, why do we have to wear these masks? And how do the rules work? How many feet do I have to be away from someone today versus tomorrow? The rules were constantly changing. It was just a massive ongoing exercise in compliance.
Yeah, yeah. And I often wondered during it, for those first two, the first 2 years, 2020 mm-hmm. to 2021, absolutely bizarre and surreal. Of course, there are other things going on then too, BLM, mm-hmm. George Floyd, and then the election, which I think was stolen. Mm-hmm. But COVID alone was enough. And then, I don't know in America, but over here, we also had, connected with COVID, the whole WEF stuff, WEF, Klaus Schwab, his wise advisor, Yuval Noah Harari.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, again, I'm sorry to keep using the word surreal, but it really was. And it felt unprecedented. It felt like this is something that is new. And, you know, some people were annoyed at people like me for talking so much about it and losing sight of other issues. But it felt at the time that we have to talk about this, and we have to explore this and study this, because it's new and it feels important. It feels like this is not going to go away. As it happens, it sort of has gone away. I think I have a theory for why that happened, because I think they meant it. I think they were serious at the time about the Great Reset and Net Zero, Agenda 2030. I think they were serious about it. But the weird thing is how that was all sort of predicated on COVID. So they got you into this disaster state, and then they were going to just transform the world around you. It was just bizarre.
Yeah. I think maybe what ended up happening with COVID was that it was an experiment to a certain extent, a social experiment of how far can you push people? How ridiculous can you become? And it is surreal. Think about the things where they had people playing musical instruments through little slits in their plastic face shields. And they had the bubbles, the literal giant air bubbles that they had people get in. That none of that seems like reality. And it's because of that mortality salience that people just have erased over it. And again, the same sort of cognitive functions that induce post-traumatic stress disorder. And they can be reawakened by signs or symbols, you know, as PTSD works. And I think that causes people to just not want to think about it. It's maybe why now masking makes some people very angry, because it's like, well, why are you masking now? It's a reminder of those times. Some people still do it, and it's still, I think, somewhat socially acceptable. Yeah, all these insane images. How is that real? But it was. And we were supposed to take it seriously, that this was going to protect people from an allegedly the deadliest virus ever. How did that ever make sense to anyone?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It was said, I mean, there were emails leaked from Fauci. What was his name? Dr. Fauci.
Anthony Fauci.
Anthony Fauci. From just a few weeks before, where he was saying, yeah, the masks won't offer any protection. And then a few weeks later, the policy was obviously decided upon. And so he changed his tune, and he was publicly saying, yeah, the masks will protect you. I mean, it was so weird. And yeah, there were many things like that throughout that 2-year period where you get some glimpse of what they're doing, and then they do it, and it's playing out that this trick, and you can see that it's a trick. Maybe there's even some evidence that it's a trick, and maybe they'll admit 2 years later that that was a trick. Yeah, we didn't know, we were just guessing, and so forth. And that happened again and again. But I agree, it was a sort of experiment. I think I assumed at the time this is a dress rehearsal for climate change.
Yeah.
They're doing this now. They're working out what techniques work, which sectors, which types of people resist the most, and who are the most compliant. And they were going to put, and I'm sure that they did collect mountains of data.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought they're going to do this again with climate change, and then it's going to be done right, full power. This is a dress rehearsal. As awful as it is, this is just a prototype. This is just a dress rehearsal. And I think I was probably right about that. I think that's probably what the intention was.
Yeah, but I don't know if they're going. I agree 100%. I had the exact same thought process about it. They keep trying, though, to kind of fearmonger with the climate change thing. And I also expected it to be climate change. But I don't know if that one's working. So I don't know what the pivot is next. But they did get mountains of useful data on who is compliant, how to make the least compliant as compliant as possible, and then just rolled it back like nothing happened. Things did happen. For example, there's been very early research on very young children who were born during the pandemic. And there was evidence that in you know, neonatal and early childhood IQ tests, they could have up to a 30-point IQ deficit. So because of, it's speculated, because 30. Of the lack of 30, yes.
That's huge.
Yes, the difference between normal and mentally retarded. Now, I don't think young children's IQ is extremely elastic and can bounce back very easily, and those measurements are not very stable inherently. However, I don't think expect a 30-point IQ deficit, but maybe expect a 5 on average. because in large part not being able to see the parents' faces because of masks, that seriously can impair a child's development in terms of particularly their emotional understanding. So you're going to maybe have a lot of children who were born during those couple of years who might have symptoms of autism who don't actually have it, for example, just because of on one factor, just not being able to see the parents' face, to say nothing about all of the other strange restrictions and the anxiety that their parents were under. By the way, also in terms of the demography data, COVID changed the number of males versus females born globally. So
how did that happen and what was the result?
So the Trevor's Willard hypothesis postulates that, or posits, excuse me, that when there are periods of very high stress, because males are less likely to reproduce, and so if you produce a fragile male, a male that's not the most fit, that's essentially a waste of resources when resources are scarce. So when a woman is pregnant with a male child, in times of adversity, of low resources, her body will abort the male fetus. Whereas a female who is more likely to reproduce and therefore pass on her genes will not be terminated in utero. So we find that, for example, when there's hurricanes, earthquakes, any other kind of natural disaster, wars are a little different because they actually tend to spur on male production. But any kind of natural disaster, famines, economic disasters, all of which are about 9 months after whatever the disaster is, you find that there is an excess of females born and an underrepresentation of males. The other thing then that you can check by that is that if you look at any country on Earth at any period in time, you can find out pretty easily what the number of males versus females born per year is. The stable average for most societies, modern societies, is 105, which means 105 males born per 100 females. If you start to see too much deviation from that, it means something strange is happening in that civilization. So, for example, what I conducted earlier this year also was that I looked at the sex ratios at birth, SRB, of the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Canada. And I found that if you look at it on just the base level, the sex ratio at birth is about stable. It's between 105 and 107 in the Anglosphere countries. But when you look at white people, the sex ratio at birth is ever so slightly lower. It's under 105 or at 105. Whereas for other groups, it can be up as high as 112, for example, Southeast Asians, 107, Southeast Asians, and Arabs as well. Now, part of that's because they practice female feticide, but it's also because when they move to more prosperous conditions from less prosperous conditions, that increases their likelihood of having a male. Whereas as white people's conditions decrease or diminish, their likelihood of having a male child decreases. That's also affected by female, the mother's age. When women give birth older, they are less likely to have sons. So we have compounding factors that are causing the West, and particularly white people in the West, to underproduce males and to overproduce females. Meanwhile, we are importing people who are more likely to have males just from a pure reality of how biology and genetics function, but then also from cultures that practice female feticide. So end up with an excess. It's the phrase invading army gets used a lot, but it doesn't just apply to the ones that are being imported. It lasts for up to four generations, these effects. So you're talking about their children, they will be more likely to have sons. Their sons will be more likely to have sons. Their sons will be more likely to have sons for four generations before it normalizes to the native population of about 105. Mm.
And in the meantime, we are less likely to have sons. So we are more likely to have daughters, and they're more likely to have sons. That's worrying.
Yes,
that's very worrying indeed. I mean, we just need mass deportation as soon as possible.
Yes,
because otherwise, our entire civilization is going to transform out of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
It really is that stark. And the thing is, if you know this stuff, then presumably the people in charge, they must know. They must know.
The Trevor's Willard thing is kind of unexplored. When I looked into that earlier this year, I found it through a very strange way. I was reading this guy's papers. He was a pediatrician who decided to publish a bunch of papers about Star Trek in a medical journal. Like, they were, it was just him rambling about Star Trek, which I found very odd. And he ended up being an expert in this sex ratio at birth stuff. So I just stumbled across it. I would be very suspect if those in charge are not aware of not just, like, you know, obviously the immediate effects of importing an invading army, but the secondary and tertiary effects of importing an invading army that will overproduce males while the local populace overproduces females, contrary to the natural balance of about 105 to 100.
Yeah. You see, this is a thing that I think a lot of people assume that, well, conspiracies are just crazy. There's no way so many people would have to be in on it. And what are the odds and how difficult it would be to maintain this and to maintain secrecy about it. And so it's just crazy talk. But the way I see it is, this is what power is for. If you're like, you know, if powerful people are not conspiring to get their way, then what is the point of them having power? I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to think that they just sit around and don't use their power, don't use their influence, don't use their wealth. Of course they do. What else would they be doing? I mean, going to the races, buying another yacht. It's ridiculous. Of course, this is what they do.
Yeah.
So I think it's very naive. And this is the sort of layman, the normie view that, I don't know, it all just happens by accident. So I remember having a conversation with a boomer guy, and he said that he had worked out in the early 70s when he was like 18, 19, that if you encourage women into the workforce, that's going to lower the birth rate because they're not going to have as many kids. Mm-hmm. And he had worked this out at 18, 19, that will make it harder for them to find a man that they fancy, that they're attracted to, because they're earning as much as he is. Well, if an 18, 19, and I don't think he wasn't boastful. He wasn't the kind of guy who's given to just inventing stuff. Now, if he had understood that as an 18, 19-year-old in the early 70s, how the fuck can you say that the people at high levels of our society didn't know that?
Yeah.
Of course they did. And yet he was convinced that, no, I knew it, I guessed it, but it wasn't deliberate. I guessed that would be the effect, but come on, it wasn't some plan. These things just happen. They just play out, and there are unforeseen effects. So I don't think he was really patting himself on the back for his cleverness. He was simultaneously saying that, no, they wouldn't make this happen deliberately. Right. That's crazy talk. This is all just unforeseen. Done with the best of intentions to give women, because, you know, he's off the boomer generation, so he thought it was all about giving women a better, more freedom, more autonomy, even despite it having these terrible effects down the line. And I thought, you're crazy. Yeah, that of course they knew. Of course they knew. And how can you think that they wouldn't know? If you knew, of course they knew. So. Yeah. It was deliberate.
Yeah, particularly with the women in the workplace stuff, there was plenty of evidence well before that was pushed through. And the fact that women didn't want it largely, in terms of even when you asked women at the time, do you want to go and work full time? Most women didn't. And with the sex ratio at birth stuff, that goes back to the first person to notice those effects was John Grant. That was in the 1700s. So there's certainly, and in fact, one of the things that's so fascinating about the sex ratio at birth stuff is that we have data on it that goes back to the 1700s because it's in baptismal data. So baptismal records are going to keep male or female, which means that you can look at, so for example, it doesn't seem that hormonal birth control affects this. And the reason that we know that is because we can trace back sex ratio at birth to the 1700s in Finland, and that which has been done, and looked at it all the way through the introduction of birth control, and found that that in particular thing, which messes up all kinds of other aspects of human relationships, does not affect sex ratio at birth. But there's also those different data sets. They exist for pretty much every Western country. And you can see and trace back. So, for example, I said wars are a little bit different. right after a war starts, sometimes there will be an increase in males that are born. And the hypothesis would be that's because we need males. And then at the end of a war, when things are very good, if you win, right, you see an extreme number of males. That's the boomers. When there are too many males in a society, you get what are called fragile males because they're in excess. And also it's because there's so many excess resources. These are males that would have been terminated in utero had times been a little bit more tough. So they're essentially males that may not have a partner, for one, just that exists out there for them. And two, they are less genetically fit males that would have likely been terminated in utero by natural biological processes had times not been so plentiful. So the boomer generation is a generation of fragile males. And what that means is that they're men who essentially don't belong. And I think that explains somewhat, or at least some aspect of the boomer mentality and psychology of the entire generation. It is a generation of fragile males.
Well, they definitely practice a lot of self-hate for their civilization, for their country, for their race. And I know that that was also drummed into them by the media when they were young. They seem, and I don't want to make this an anti-boomer thing, because the millennials we have our own problems.
Yes.
But that does seem to have been a thing really consistently. I mean, you can talk to old boomers now who are still convinced that we've just got to give everything up to the third world, or just got to get as many Africans in here as possible so that they can have a shot at life and getting rich. I imagine it's even more pronounced in America. I think
that
British boomers are, because Britain didn't have such a wealthy late 20th century, so they're a bit more muted in this, but they still do tend to believe in nothing but money, nothing but economics, material things. It's a tragic. And we're at this stage now where we're sort of having to parent them in a certain way, because we seem to understand things that they don't, or at least we see the importance of things that they don't see the importance of. So it's a weird situation to be in. To get back to COVID, my thesis about this, my theory about this is that October the 7th in Israel, they realized that it's now or never for Israel. So we've got to do this now. So we'll let October 7th happen. And so then that enables us to go to war with Gaza. But we're going to need an American president who is sympathetic to us. So instead of Kamala, we'll back Trump. And I think that was probably the right decision for them. I think Kamala would have been even more, should have been flaky. And whereas Trump is completely philo-Semitic. So I think that is why the whole Great Reset thing was aborted. Because I think otherwise they would have just continued with it. I think they were going to. I think that they had every intention of, I think they were serious. I don't think this was some joke, like a huge elaborate thing that had no end game to it. I think they had a big plan. And basically the plan was, we're going to do this again with climate change, and it's going to be bigger, and it's going to go on for a very fucking long time.
Yeah.
And so this is why you've got to get used to this. Now we're not returning to the old normal. From now on, it is going to be digital ID for everything monitored and all the rest of it. And the pretext will be climate change. We're going to save the climate. But even that, I think is a lot of rubbish. But that never mattered. That was just the pretext. Mm-hmm. So, that's my theory. And I think because of October the 7th, that sort of nixed that whole thing. And so what they're doing now is settling on digital ID. So they don't need the whole 30-minute cities and owning nothing and being happy. Mm-hmm. They just want everyone to be on digital ID. That's the crucial thing. So that's my theory. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if October 7th derailed it, or if the point was not to wait a bit longer to let the pressure release valve go off on it. You don't want to jump, because I at least have seen it over the last couple years since COVID was put away, in that it was, every couple months you see it. oh, there's a new strain of this, there's a new strain of that, there's a new disease. And it seems like it's sort of being floated by the media to see, wait, can we do this again yet? Obviously, Israel-Palestine, has replaced it in terms of the what's the big issue in the zeitgeist. And that may have been completely on accident. That's just, we have to pivot to this now. And I agree also completely that Trump was the correct choice over Kamala, because Trump could sell it better. As an actor, he can certainly sell it a little bit better than I think Kamala could have. I think she would have struggled to be able to maintain any sort of level of support while backing Israel, the way that Trump is managing to amongst many, again, because they've already invested so much and he's now the comeback kid, all of this stuff. First things he does is basically, just declare his allegiance to Israel as soon as he gets back in office. So, but he's back. So things are good. We got our guy back. We've been vindicated. And well, people apparently the distance, you know.
Yeah, apparently army recruitment shot up in America, surely, in the months after his inauguration.
Right.
So I remember people saying, well, there you go. That's why he's in. That's mm-hmm. why he's president again, because they wanted this effect.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I definitely think that Trump was, well, depending on how you want to view this. I think if Biden had stayed in the race, he wouldn't have won either. Nor would Kamala. They had no real chance because they were jokes, and I think that was on purpose. Trump was essentially, I believe, allowed to win for this exact reason. Obviously, October 7th. Aside or whatever, it seemed that there was a sort of, well, we want to go in this direction now. Trump should be back in power because he's useful. And so it was a complete farce. Like, Hillary stood no chance in 2016 either. She was unelectable. I think maybe Trump was allowed to be elected or set up to be elected in 2016, despite, you know, yes, there was all this grassroots stuff around it, but that may have been the case because Hillary was such a joke. And obviously, much more so a joke in terms of Biden and Kamala, because there was no leadership potential in either one of them. People didn't see any of that. People just kind of pretended those years didn't exist.
Yeah, and I don't blame anyone for trying to blank those years out of there. I mean, it was a nightmare. But it's interesting to remember that the first year, like 2020, that was Trump who was in office during that insane year of COVID, the summer of Floyd, all of that, BLM going crazy, burning down. So that was all under Trump. Mm-hmm. And Biden only showed up at the end of that. Well, he didn't even. It was the election happened at the end of that year. It's funny to think, you know, because the height of all of this was actually under Trump.
Yes.
And I remember, you know, even if you go back, Charlottesville, that happened under Trump. All Antifa, beating people up and getting away with things, that was all under him. So it's a weird thing where he was in office and supposedly a dictator, but everything went the left's way throughout his first presidency. There's really, I don't know, maybe if I were in America, I would know, I would be able to list some things that he actually did do and ways in which things went the other way, but I can't think of anything. So really, that first presidency and then the Biden presidency was 8 years of leftism. And then, of course, you've got Obama before him. So this now, Trump's second presidency, is really the first time that there's been it feels like at least something right-wing is happening. Now, it's not what I would want, not what most of my followers, my fans would want, but but it has a different tenor from his first presidency, when it just seemed like he was just flailing around. Because, I think he's got more of a loyal team this time.
That's certainly part of it. Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it is the team around him. I also think that you are talking about if these things are, and they don't have to be so carefully constructed by some secret, you know, cabal that's operating in obfuscation. They're just nudges, just little psychological nudges that you push upon the populace, and all of a sudden things fall into place. Trump was useful to in some senses, I'm sure. Trump also removing Trump was very useful. There's the the release valve on the pressure there, that all that societal angst that had been built up from the 4 years under him. And yeah, there's all of the summers of love, et cetera. Well, not all of them, but that's when it started, was under Trump. The mass rioting, violence in the streets, the Antifa stuff, that was all under Trump. It was starting before that, but that's when it really ramped up. I looked recently at the terrorism reports, long-term data going back to the 1960s, or actually 1970s, from the Global Terrorism Database, and then the persons of individual radicalization in the United States PIRIS database, which goes back to 1947. And I found that consistently, you basically would have a period of like increased terrorism under a certain president of one side or the other, and then you have the next president, and there's a cooling off period from that particular side, whichever side loses. They cool off when their guy's not in power. It's the other way around though. This is specific. It is right v. left. The left, when they are not in power, becomes far, far, far more antagonistic and more violent. But their antagonism and violence continues on when they do get in power. When the right is in power, they stop being violent. They stop engaging in terroristic activity to the same degree. And how you code left versus right terrorism, particularly going back to the 1940s, is a bit murky. But that seemed to be the trend, particularly when I looked at data since 1990. When the right's in power, they cool off. When the left's in power, they don't.
I can give a good example of this. In the 80s, in Britain, we had Margaret Thatcher mm-hmm. and her supposedly hard right government. And the left, because they didn't have governmental power, they switched to other forms of changing society in other ways. And so that was the media, obviously, but also education. That was when education was dumbed down in Britain in a big way, and new priorities were installed in it. And of course, that continued in the 90s. And so while, my point is that while we were supposedly under this hard right government, which shouldn't allow anything like that to happen, it was happening mm-hmm. because it was leftists at a lower level than the government were doing this activism.
Yeah. And don't forget that in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a huge swathe across the Western world of environmental terrorism from the left that they were engaging in, that which is almost entirely forgotten about now. It's somehow been seemingly erased. The people who were pro trees and anti animal abuse or whatever, these people were out there committing just constant acts of terrorism during the late 80s and early 90s.
True. That there was an organization, and sorry to interrupt, but I just remembered an example. There was an organization in Britain called the Animal Liberation Front, and they did
ALF.
Horrible, mm-hmm. horrible things to during the 90s. So yeah, just to back you up.
Yeah, and those were global organizations, but with those data as well, I looked at both the US and UK in terms of terrorism rates, who actually does violence. And what I found there too was that the left plans violence at the exact same rate as the right, if not more so, in terms of plots that are detected or completed. However, the right is extremely more efficacious at violence, I guess is a nice way of saying skill issue, which is that when the left does violence, it's far more likely to, or it's far less likely to result in death or injury. When the right does violence, it's far more likely to result in death and injury. And no one competes with the Muslims. So, because their numbers are quite literally off the charts. You can't see the other two if you put their data into the equation.
God almighty.
Yeah.
And again, you just come back to the insanity of immigration policy over the last mm-hmm. 50 years. I mean, what on earth? How on earth could you do this and think it was going to turn out well? It's and again, you have to conclude that they knew it wasn't going to turn out well because they're not retarded.
Yeah.
At least America has been spared that up until quite recently. I mean, the Boston bombers, that was what, about 20, when was that? Was that 2017? I've got a feeling that was.
I think so. 2017 sounds right. It's been spared at, I actually don't know. I think I did tell you this, but I've lived in.
It was 2013.
It was further away from that. I've lived in Guernsey for the last 6 years, so I've been on this side of the pond for a long time now. So my knowledge on a lot of this stuff has changed, and my opinions on it as well. But what was the point now? Oh, the Boston bomber. Yeah. Oh God, now I've lost my train of thought.
We were talking about the left being better, well, being more incompetent at violence, and
right.
the right during. And I think it was about Muslims and Islam, and I said it's America hasn't had much of that. But then in 2013, there was an Islamic terror attack by people.
There have been a few. I mean, obviously 9/11, but then you do also look at, you know, Americans in particular. When I lived there and got only sort of that sort of side of things, have a very catastrophized idea of the state of the United Kingdom and just how overrun it is. And it's not good, but I think people get the idea that every single town is full of Muslims. However, that is also happening in the United States. Look at Michigan, look at Minnesota. There's huge areas of both of those states that are essentially Muslim enclaves. So it's happening there as well, and it's starting to pick up more attention in the United States. But perhaps because of the US's just enormous size, it does get held into these local sort of enclaves in a way that you can't escape as much if you're talking about a much more industrialized nation, and where every much more of it is covered in towns and cities. There's less just totally open free space as there is in the US. Like the whole Midwest is, you know, a lot of just open area. So it's easier to get away from things in the US, which makes it seem more diffuse. And I guess it is more diffuse, but the same problems are arising in places like Dearborn, Michigan, for example.
Oh yeah, Dearborn's famous. And, it's more diffuse, but that doesn't actually, that provides an illusion of safety, because it's still the same process that's happening. It just means that there are more places to run away to white flight to, but that's not going to last long. Yeah, exactly. You run out of them. Even in a place like America, you will run out of them. So it's not an answer. It's not a solution. Okay. Is there anything else you'd want to say about Trump's second run?
I was still hopeful. I think despite all my reservations about obviously democracy as a process and as a system, but I still thought, well, maybe Trump would be better than Kamala, I suppose. And yet has been an utter disappointment in almost every way that there have been good things. There have been some good things, but the philo-Semitism is repulsive and overwhelming and difficult to appreciate anything good that he does because of his clear devotion to another master.
The Jeffrey Epstein stuff especially was so sad to see this guy humiliating himself to saying that it was a hoax and all that. We all know it's obvious what the situation is. He was working for Mossad and he was running a blackmail operation and getting lots of politicians and famous people into compromising situations. Mm-hmm. It's obvious. It's very straightforward. You can say it in one sentence like I just did. That's clearly what was going on. That's why he got his massive wealth in the first place. It's how he had an island when he was a fucking math teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, circle that square. Yeah.
Yeah, it's obvious. But since we're on this topic, how does it feel living in Guernsey? You don't have the protection of the First Amendment anymore, and you're subject to hate speech laws. That must be kind of weird as an American.
It's not. Guernsey is a crown dependency, but it's autonomous. So we actually don't get any of that stuff, luckily.
Right. Okay.
On Twitter, it says, you know, back when you could choose your location before it was revealed for you, I set my location to Ancapistan, and I did that like when I made the Twitter account in 2017, and then I ended up kind of moving to Ancapistan, and now I'm not a libertarian nor anarcho-capitalist whatsoever anymore. So
you're looking for monarchistan now. Yeah. Sorry, that's my ignorance. I thought that Channel Islands were under British. I knew that they were semi-independent at least, but I thought that they were still under British law. That's my ignorance, everyone. Sorry, I've just shown myself up.
Well, no, there's no reason why. I mean, between Guernsey and Jersey, it's, what, maybe 200,000 people between all the Channel Islands? Or at least, I think all of them probably about 200,000 people. So it's not a lot. They're crown dependencies, so ultimately they do rely on the British government, but they are autonomous in a lot of ways. Now, there's a BBC station here, you know.
I'm sorry about that.
Well, right, you know, they use pound notes, but they do set the rules, and that's why, for example, marijuana is legal here. Again, I would, if you want to come to Guernsey, feel free to visit. It's a great place to visit. You cannot move here because one of the things that's quite based about it is that you cannot become a citizen if you are not from here. If my husband and I had children, they would be citizens, but I can never be, ever. Which is, but again, a lot of people from the mainland buy homes over here, but they also can't buy them. There's a closed market and an open market. Foreigners aren't allowed to buy or sell homes on the closed market. That's only for citizens. So there's all kinds of things that are actually really neat that help preserve and this particular island's heritage, which includes, they are losing their language, Guernesais, which is Norman French. But there are still attempts currently to protect that language. And you can do that kind of on a very small island with 80,000 people on it. Astonishingly, in the British Isles right now, it exists, you know.
Yeah. I think that sort of thing should be done. People preserving the languages. People often mock the SNP in Scotland for everything. Well, and for everything else, yeah. I agree. But on this one thing about preserving Gaelic, I think that's right. And I know it's clumsy. No one speaks it, so it's kind of ridiculous to have the railway signs in Gaelic. I know, but I think it's a good idea anyway. It's just a pet hobby horse of mine. But I never really talk about it, but it's something that I do think it's a good idea. I think it should be done. And the thing is, it goes both ways. You can say, well, that's a way for them to cut the Scots off from the English, like globalists. Then the Scots and the English have a more profound separation, and then they're more vulnerable to the EU and to whatever. Sure, that's true, but it's also the case that English makes everyone susceptible to global homo, and it's also the case that having your own language is a key part of cultural identity. So. Yeah, if you weigh it up, I think it's best. I think it's better to have your own language. One of the depressing things is when you hear about. I mean, it's great when you hear Danes and Dutch and Germans, and they speak better English than we do. But at the same time, it's impressive. But at the same time, it's kind of sad because it means that their language, their hold on their own language is being eroded because they can all speak English to each other. Yeah. I mean, like a bunch of Dutch guys could have a conversation in English because they all speak it. So
yeah, my co-host, he's South African. So he speaks Dutch, sort of, but we always speak in English.
It's good to have a universal language, but of course it's useful. And it's kind of embarrassing. You know, I remember when I was doing a lot of conferences and you travel around and everyone, like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Austria, Norway, they all speak perfect English. And there's me and I only speak one language. So it is embarrassing. But at the same time, it's useful to have this universal language that people can all communicate in. I just worry that it erodes their own language and their own mastery of it. Because they're all watching, like the young are all watching YouTube and TikTok and all this. So they end up absorbing that. And I actually hear that in young British people. I can hear that their accents are more American.
Yeah.
Because they're watching, this is what they watch. So that's what they grow up with. And, you know, you can say it's just an organic development. And yes, it is. But it's unfortunate, you know, because it means that the English people, the Scottish people of tomorrow, or even today, frankly, sound less so than their parents and grandparents did.
Yeah. There's also the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which is that people's language, whatever their language is, affects their cognitions. So there's a group in the Amazon rainforest called the Paraha, and they only have so many, like 3 vowels and 15 consonants or something to that effect. So they have a very limited language. They can only make so many sounds. And for them, things like time and place and numbers don't exist because they don't have words for them. When someone dies and you say, where did grandpa go? They he walked off into the forest or something. I don't know. I don't remember. They have no concept of permanence because they don't have words or the language for it. And Sapir-Whorf predicts, which is evolutionary psychology, predicts that whatever someone's native language is will affect the way that they see the world, understand the world, and interact with it. And so when people lose that difference by maybe learning, say, English simultaneous along with their mother tongue, that can change the way, literally change the way that they perceive reality and they interact with reality, if Sapir-Whorf is correct.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't know, Orwell had this idea that all thought is verbal. So You have to have language without, you cannot think without using language. I don't know if I actually agree with that. I think a lot of thought is pre-verbal. It's instinctual. Mm-hmm. It's not verbalized. And then in the next split second, you may attach words to it. That's what I think. But he was quite adamant about that. I can't remember in which essay or I can't remember where he said that. But anyway, so it makes sense that, of course, the language you speak is going to affect the ways that you handle the world, the way that you conceive of things, the way mm-hmm. that you think about them. So I don't see how that's remotely controversial. And so when a language is eroded, so is the handling of the world mm-hmm. that accompanied that language.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, obviously, there's been some attention to the African languages that have no word for maintenance, for example. I don't think most of the largely spoken African languages have no word for maintenance. And so, of course, when it comes to, are you going to maintain the things that the Europeans left there for you? They don't even understand the concept. Now, I agree that I think a lot of things are pre-verbal or before you're starting to think about the concept before you've put even like mental word to it. But if there is no mental word, does the concept get fully formed as easily, perhaps for as many people? If there's no word for something, some construct, can it fully exist, or is it too hypothetical? If there's no way to describe it, and English is a fantastic language for that, as is German, for coming up with new words essentially to describe new phenomenon, whereas other languages are less equipped to do that, and so perhaps less advantageous in things like science and technology.
Yeah, well, German is famous for this. There are words for shades of things in between two English words, mm-hmm. and we don't have a word that quite captures that exact thing. I don't know what the total number of words is in German and English, but either way, they seem to have a word for everything. And mm-hmm. of course, then they can concatenate words in a way that doesn't happen in English. But the point is, if you learn German, if you become very good, if you are a German and you learn your language, then you have words for things that an English-speaking person doesn't have words for. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's going to affect your thinking. And then there are the grammatical structures, the rules. Again, that must affect how you think and how you handle the world. So I think this is true, and this is one of the reasons I do approve of preserving dying languages, even mm-hmm. if it's kind of arduous and a bit silly. I think it's a good idea. Like, if it feels a bit silly, I still think it's a good idea. All right, so this is we'll get to some super chats here. Dawn says, thank you, amazing woman. Is she spoken for? Asking for several friends. Well, Dawn, after you sent that super chat, she did mention a husband. So, that question's answered. But nonetheless, Dawn thinks you're amazing. So thank you, Dawn. I should say Dawn is a woman. It's D-A-W-N. So she's trying to matchmake. All right. Soccer City. Aidan Paladin is a wonderful and noble guest, truly refreshing. Stay optimistic. Don't ever doubt our people. Every woman like Aidan inspires 100, and those inspired men themselves inspire 1,000. 2026 is ours. Seize it. Soccer City is an interesting guy, and he's going to be on Millennial. I don't remember when. Hold on a second. But he's an interesting guy. He's got some interesting ideas. Yeah. Let me see. Another few nights from now. So he'll be on the night before Christmas Eve. And he's got ideas about, which actually might be of interest to you, Aidan, about white people going into the university as as mature students, because he says you can have a nice life doing that, because he's in Canada and the Canadian government gives you loads of money to do that.
reading some green post forever ago from some guy in Italy who'd just been doing that for like 20 years, just kind of living a student life. And I think particularly now, there is maybe some desire for that. We'll see what happens with it. Or there's at least opportunities for it. You may be kept out of actual academic professions. You won't get hired to for a professorship, but you can kind of hang out there for almost free for a long time.
As I say, they actually in Canada, this guy Stoker City is actually getting money from the government to do these courses, and he's got a whole thing to say about it. And I do think that one might be of interest to you particularly, and I'm sure that there are equivalent programs, if not in Guernsey, then definitely in the United States.
Well, there's no university here, so no, I've been doing just the internet stuff for it. But yeah, I'm. Actually, probably there isn't, because I'm a foreigner, which again, based, but you know, I'd rather it be that way than and me not get benefits because of that than anyone get them who's a foreigner.
Yeah. So of course, because we all know what that results in.
Right. Yes.
Excellent. Well, let's end it there, unless there's anything else that you'd like to say about 2025. I don't know. Is there the events? I've gone through them with other guests, but. I should have asked you at the start, is there anything that you'd like to bring up?
Nothing in particular that I can think of, other than that it has been a significant disappointment. Not unforeseen, not a complete blindside if you were paying attention, but it has been a disappointment to see what's happened with Trump. And it also is a bit disappointing to see things play out as I have been seen coming down the pipeline for a long time in the UK as well. Regarding reform, so because I think that's basically unquestionable at this point. And I think it's going to be more disappointment for a lot of people like it was with Trump, or is currently with Trump. I think you're going to see a lot of that disappointment with Farage. I hope I'm wrong, but I fear that will be the case.
Oh, I think you're definitely correct. I'm sure of it. And I don't like saying that. And the thing is, I'm not that pessimistic. I'm not pessimistic about our long-term chances and the long-term prognosis, but I have said for a long time, I think that the near term, the near future and mid future is going to be difficult. And that only was cemented by the events of this year. But nonetheless, I think it's actually been quite a good year in some ways. I think there are reasons for optimism, and the main thing is just that people seem to be, like the masses, the normies, seem to be waking up to our ideas in a big way, especially in Britain. That's a cope. I don't think I'm deluding myself. It's like you hear people saying things that they just wouldn't have said 5 years ago, people
2 years ago, I think, maybe even. The expedience with which that has occurred, particularly regarding remigration, has been rather astonishing, honestly, at how quickly these things that people would not have said, certainly 5 years ago, or would have been, made you persona non grata for 5 years ago, are no longer the case.
Yeah, definitely. When did you leave America? When did you move to Guernsey?
2019. So,
all right. So
it's
you,
been a while,
right,
yeah.
So so you saw the. Well, you were near to Britain when the Boris wave happened.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So, yeah, you would be aware of that. You might even have visited, I don't know if you visited Britain, the mainland, before and after that, because you would certainly see a difference in the towns and villages.
Yeah. I mean, I visit quite frequently, but I always have only really ever gone to like Birmingham, Manchester, the big cities, you know. So, and I always only stay to either go someplace or go to a conference or meet with friends or something. So, you know, my perspective on that is very outside still, because it's idyllic here in Guernsey and untouched. All the boats go right past because they can't land here. They won't let them. But so they do forego a whole bunch of islands that are in the way to get to the first place they can possibly land to have freedom and safety or whatever. However, I did notice that the first time I was in London versus the most recent time was like basically night and day, just in the level of deterioration in 5 to 6 years, felt in the same area too. So just seen it in 6 years deteriorate to a pretty extensive degree. And then when I've gone back to the States too, it's strange because I don't go there often, and I've gone back to see my parents, and I also see things deteriorate there at a, not at the same rate, but it's slower, but it's the same direction, the same valence, and where things are headed in the West.
Amazing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We seem to be living in this age of decay. I remember when I visited America, well, once when I was like 13, and I think that was 1996, yeah, or 7, can't remember. And that was a, you know, it was a kid's experience. It was mm-hmm. Disneyland and all
yeah.
that. But I visited it again as an adult in 2016, and there was it just wasn't as gleaming as I was expecting. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a sense of like, this is on the decline, and I've been told that that's only continued in the years since. And it's sad. I don't want to dwell on it, but yeah, you see with the demographics. Mm-hmm. In Britain, it's just bad for a society. It's just bad for a place to become more third world, because it's the old thing: you import the third world, you become the third world. You start living by third world ways, and even manners, politeness, the basics of civic life become degraded and coarsened. And this is very predictable. It's amazing how closely correlated it is with the genetics that are present. That will affect everything else. And this seems to be playing out. And as I say, it looks like everyone else is now starting to see that in a way that they didn't see it 2 or 3 years ago. And so I think that's good. That's hold on to that, because it means that dissidents like us are not going to be alone anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the near future there are going to be many, many, many more people who agree with us. So I think it's been a horrible, it's been an unpleasant and arduous time from 2017 to here, the last time you and I spoke. But I do think things are heading in a direction, if not of improvement, then at least of less isolation than we have had to endure. So,
yeah, I hope so.
All right. On that optimistic note, let's end it there. This is a slightly shorter one than usual, but I am getting tired. It's been a night with some considerable upheaval. So, but I want to thank Aidan again for stepping in at the last minute. I was going to invite her on next year, but when the Sam Dixon stuff happened, I quickly contacted her and she said, yeah, she could make it. So I'm really glad as well, because this has been a unique and interesting conversation. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Okay, I'll be back tomorrow with John Waters, Old Stirling, who's a Scottish guy, and I don't know how to pronounce this. Wilhelm Iverson. It's American Krogan. And then Chris Bruni. And then the Winter Solstice AMA. So that should be fun. That's 5 streams. Hopefully it will go to plan. Most of the nights have gone to plan. It's only the last 2 that have been disrupted. But anyway, that's tomorrow night. In the meantime, Aidan Paladin, sorry it was so long. I hope it won't be another 8 years before you're back on Millennial. So thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. See you all later. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.